Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
This is for the latest installment in our What If series, where we look at some of history's, well, strange and wacky schemes that almost went ahead. We're looking tonight at a plan to drastically reshape cemeteries. When London was pondering how to handle its growing population in the 19th century, the city was also grappling with how to house not just the living, but the dead, a problem that many of our capital cities are now facing today. Well, back then, architect Thomas Wilson thought he had the perfect solution, a pyramid mortuary. Imagine an Egyptian pyramid in a London park with millions of dead crammed in. Well, I'm joined tonight by Dr. Julie Rugg from the University of York, who's done a lot of research on cemeteries in England. Hello, Julie. Welcome.
Oh, very pleased to be with you.
Now, take us back. I think we're going back to 1830s London, and just explain to us sort of how problematic dealing with the dead bodies was for the city at the time.
So the city grew very, very, very rapidly. And the problem really was about sort of densification. And again, this is a problem that's very common in cities today, that the central parts of the city were relying on churchyards that were very small. A lot of the churchyards were no more than an acre in size. They couldn't expand because they were all crammed in. And the problem was not just the number of burials that were taking place in the churchyards, but the fact that those burials were taking place in churchyards where burial had taken place for sometimes centuries. The land was literally saturated with the dead. It wasn't possible to add new burials to that land and those burials to decompose. The ground simply couldn't take it. It sounds really grim, and it was very, very grim. We've got lots of accounts at the time of just how awful the situation was. It must have absolutely, I mean, the smell was just terrible. People always talked about the smell. But also at that time, people thought that the smell carried disease. So not only did it absolutely stink, people thought that smelling that smell would make them very, very ill. So it was seen to be a massive problem at the time.
So what were the individual cemeteries and the churchyards doing then? I mean, would they say, no, we just can't take anyone else here?
Well, you'd hoped they would have done, but they didn't. They just carried on. And churchyards started to actually sort of rise, you know, slightly above. They'd sometimes bring in a bit of extra soil and they'd start to sort of climb in height. We don't have many sort of accounts of churchyards saying, OK, we're closed now. They would just continue to try. There was sort of like lots of little initiatives. So individual sort of entrepreneurs would open chapels, for example, and say, OK, we've got burial vaults underneath the chapel, so we can do that. So different people were trying different kinds of solutions to try and create additional space. But none of those solutions were at the scale that was needed for a city as big as London.
I must say, you remind me, Julie, I was in the UK last year and we went to Bath and did a tour of the cathedral there, and they told us a story that they were burying bodies literally under the cathedral floor to the point where the entire place just absolutely stank. No one wanted to go to church on a Sunday because it smelled so terrible.
I don't think we can. I think we live in a fairly sort of fragrant world nowadays. I don't think we can possibly understand how revolting the 19th century must have smelled.
Dr. Julie Rugg is here. Julie's a scholar on cemeteries at the University of York School for Business and Society. So here we have architect Thomas Wilson, who proposed the giant pyramid. How would this have worked?
So Thomas Wilson, I kind of sometimes I think, where on earth did this idea come from? And in some ways you think, yes, so we'll talk about the Egyptian thing in a minute. But his thought was giant, giant pyramid. What we can do is build this huge structure. It was intended to be 90 odd stories high. And each structure, every single layer of this structure would be full of vaults, and the vaults would contain many people. So his thought was, actually, let's build up. Let's forget about building down. Let's build up and make a structure tall enough to accommodate all the dead that we need to accommodate. And strangely prescient in a way, because if you go to some Asian sort of city, places like Hong Kong, Singapore, they're also building very tall structures for the dead now, sort of multi-story places. But he was an early precursor. So in the 1820s, he's thinking, let's build a huge, big pyramid. His intention was it was going to take something like 40,000 burials a year. I mean, it was going to be absolutely massive. He was going to build it on top of Primrose Hill, which was one of the biggest, it's a big hill overlooking London. So not only would it be enormous, but it would absolutely tower over the city. You would probably be able to see it from every point in the city.
Now, as you said, we can talk about the Egyptians. And if we look at the era, 1820s, 1830s, I mean, sort of the British were only in Egypt fighting Napoleon, I think, just at the very start of the 19th century. Egypt's kind of fresh in everybody's mind, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Let's just say it was the sexy thing. I mean, to be Egyptian, you know, any kind of Egyptian design was just the thing to be. And I think the thing that's the confluence of two things was, firstly, Egyptians very, very popular in terms of design, because it was sort of a new thing. It was a sort of like a new, it's a bit like Japanese stuff that happens at the end of the 19th century. It's just something so new. But then that association between Egyptian and death, you know, that the pyramids were these spaces of death. And the notion that actually we've got this new form, you know, so we need new types of burial space. It seemed obvious to associate these new burial spaces with Egyptian design. So a lot of the new cemeteries that were established actually had Egyptian design elements, you know, built into the sort of architecture. So certainly it was never the case that a pyramid was built. But those elements of Egyptian design you can see in an awful lot of the early cemeteries from the 1830s, 1840s.
Okay, can you give us an example of one of those and what we might see?
So, for example, if you go to Sheffield, for example, very, very, you know, lots of cemeteries, we think outside of London, Sheffield built a cemetery in the 1830s. And if you go up to the front gate, there is an emblem that's built into the gate, and it's a snake eating its own tail. So that kind of design. Even in York, where I live, the chapel, if you go to the chapel in the cemetery, that was also built in the 1830s, the design of the windows is Egyptian. So the window design is very, very Egyptian in its scale and its in the way that it sort of sits. It's a very odd combination of neoclassical and in Egyptian design. It's very weird. So these sort of motifs sort of appear quite a lot within Egyptian design, within cemetery design in different ways.
Wow, fascinating. Dr. Julie Rugg is here. Julie's a scholar on cemeteries at the University of York School for Business and Society. So how seriously was Thomas Wilson's proposal for the big pyramid of the dead taken?
You know, yeah, I think probably not very. It's kind of, I think in part because, I mean, I'll tell you, one of the things that he misunderstood the English appetite for not being buried in the ground. So a lot of the new cemeteries that came up in the 1820s, 30s, they spent a lot of money building catacombs, thinking that people would like to be buried above ground in catacombs. But the English really don't like that idea. And very many of these catacombs remained empty. People didn't want to use them. Highgate built catacombs, and actually they weren't very popular at all because we really prefer to be in the ground. That's kind of how our culture. So I kind of wonder if he had managed to get all of these people on board and he had managed to build it, I kind of wonder if it would have just been empty, which would have been a bit bizarre, but to have, you know, spent that much money. But he then later sort of transferred his interest to the big sort of new cemetery garden concept, you know, the sort of, and he joined up with the directors of the General Cemetery Company that established Kensal Green. So the thing about the pyramid and his design for the pyramid, at that time, it was quite popular to sort of do cemetery design. Lots of wacky ideas being floated for different things just to try and catch the public imagination. And I wonder how serious some of these things really were.
Yeah, well, I hear that local residents objected to the idea of the horrible abomination, and I guess it would have been kind of pretty hard to build a giant pyramid too.
Well, I don't know. I think the Egyptians managed it, you know, and they didn't have many of the sort of advantages that the Victorians would have had.
That's true, so, but they seem to know how to do things that we then forgot for a couple of thousand years.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, absolutely. I think there was that problem there. But I think there would have been a lot of, I don't think it would have carried through particularly. I think, you know, the objections would have quashed it. So it wasn't really going to happen. So And I kind of, the idea of it is quite horrifying if you think about it for any length of time, isn't it really?
Yes.
Because we've got all of these sort of, we've got all these bodies sort of high up in the air thinking, oh, I'm not really sure about this, sort of like looming over people. It doesn't feel very comforting, does it really?
Oh, Julie, I can sense that given the opportunity, you wouldn't choose to have this pyramid as your final resting place.
No, you know what? I was thinking about this yesterday and I was thinking, you know, that I had this horrific image in my mind. And the horrific image I had was, okay, let's say he built it. Let's say he filled it and made lots of money, which was his primary intention, to make lots of money. What would have happened during the Second World War?
Oh my goodness.
Can you imagine that sort of structure being subject to that level of bombardment? I kind of like, my stomach is turning over thinking about it. And I'm just so pleased it didn't happen.
Oh dear. So as you said, there was money to be made though. So what this problem was so great was it that, you know, we've got nowhere to put our bodies, our dead, that what people kind of money makers swept in thinking, oh, well, I've got some ideas.
I think the by the time he comes along, and he comes along with a joint stock idea. So the whole notion of a joint stock cemetery company, by the time he's coming along in the late 1820s, we've got half a dozen of these companies already operating and proving to be reasonably profitable. But these are companies that weren't built on some crazy mad idea. They're built actually by nonconformists who want their own burial space that's not part of the Church of England. So they're doing, you know, they're taking this kind of particular step as a way of defining their own identity, creating their own space. People are saying, oh gosh, that looks quite profitable though. And lots of people then start to sort of steal that idea and come up with speculative notions of different ways of using that idea to make money. So it's kind of like they kind of subvert the whole notion of independent, fair, equitable burial space and think, oh, well, if there's money to be made, we'll give it a go. So you get a whole sort of raft of speculative notions coming in. Particularly, we have these big joint stock booms that happen in the mid-30s and the mid-40s where everybody's throwing money at joint stock ventures because it looks to be the way to make a lot of cash. And so we've got sort of like, there was a company, I think, that tried to establish cemeteries that were linked by waterways. You know, that everybody would be travelling by water. And that would be the way that the cemetery sort of like attracted its clientele. So lots of like strange, odd sort of notions of ways of dealing with things. But they're all just speculations. They're intending to get people's money, buy some shares, they'd disappear with the cash. They just needed to look a little bit plausible.
So what ended up happening to solve this problem, which as you described to us, Julie, was so overbearing?
The two or three things. So a number of cemetery companies opened in the 1830s and 1840s in London and throughout the country. So we have well over 100 cemetery companies established throughout the UK with the principal purpose was we need to relieve burial space from the centre of the city, relocate it to the outside so we can stop this miasmic sort of like, you know, concentration of toxicity in the centre of town. So all of these companies were establishing new cemeteries which were relieving the churchyards. The church itself was not unbusy in this space. It was also establishing new churchyards and extending its existing churchyards where it could. But even then, you know, we still needed more. And actually by the time we got to the 1850s, we changed the legislation entirely. So we made it possible. We made it a lot easier for local communities to establish their own cemeteries on a much cheaper basis and not linked to profit. So there were the new municipal cemeteries then sort of came along from the 1850s. And really, that's the time when you get the big cemetery establishment in the UK from 1850 onwards. Lots of local communities establishing their own cemeteries using the local rates and with no intention of making money out of the venture.
And Julie, you said that you think the English culture is very much that you like to be buried underground, not up high. Have many English, I mean, what's the view on cremation in England today?
Oh, cremation. So cremation sort of kicks off in the 1880s as a notion, but it really doesn't start to get sort of like capture the public imagination really until the 1930s, 40s. I think in part, and there's been people working on this recently, in part, there was this sort of, firstly, there was sort of the early adapters of cremation. It was seen to be quite an elite thing. And so, you know, if you had lots of money, you wanted to sort of show that you were very, very ahead of the curve, you would be cremated. It wasn't a popular thing. And there was lots of discussion about the technicalities of cremation and how modern it was. But it was really only when they started to rethink, you know, what do people find consoling about cremation? Nobody's going to be consoled by the idea of a machine. So they started to advertise cremation in terms of the gardens of remembrance that would be created. So they linked cremation with gardens. They said, you'll be cremated, you're creating a garden. And that then sort of made people think, yes, I can envisage myself in a garden. I can't envisage myself standing next to a machine, but a garden, it brings consolation. And I think there's a sort of a shift in the notion of what could cremation bring us? And it could bring us beautiful gardens. And I think that really creates a different level of interest in it. For us, cremation rates really started to rocket after the Second World War. So certainly from the 1960s onwards, we get big increases in cremation. Now we're about 80-odd% cremation rate.
Well, I'm sure the Giant Pyramid would have been quite the tourist attraction, but it sounds like you're particularly glad that it never came to fruition.
Yeah, we're very glad about that.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us on Nightlife to talk us through the idea and some of the trends in burial in the UK over the years.
Great. Thank you ever so much for getting in touch. Thank you.
That's Dr. Julie Rugg, a scholar on cemeteries at the University of York School for Business and Society.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.